Welcome to the Precision Guided Podcast, the official podcast of the Georgetown Security Studies Review, where we cover all things national security, military, foreign policy, and history. Thank you for joining us today. I'm your host, Kelsey Herman. Today's guest is Caitlin Johnson, and she's going to come and talk to us about cislunar security. Caitlin Johnson is a space policy subject matter expert. She currently serves as the Deputy Director of the U.S. Space Force's Chief of Space Operations, CSO, Strategic Initiatives Group. In this role, Mrs. Johnson works across the Space Force headquarters and field staffs to provide advice, organization, and strategic messaging recommendations to the current CSO, General B. Chance Saltzman. Mrs. Johnson has expertise from her many years at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, CSIS, Aerospace Security Project. At CSIS, she led multi-year interdisciplinary projects on subjects such as adversarial counterspace weapons developments, defenses against counterspace weapons, international space norms and behaviors, cislunar space environment and policy, NATO's space policy and vision, and the history and establishment of the U.S. Space Force. She received her master's degree from American University and her bachelor's degree from the Georgia Institute of Technology. Cislunar and lunar security feels very science fiction. It feels very fantastical and not at all like something that impacts our security today. And the reality is it does, or it will very soon in the future. As space becomes this domain of sort of contestation and competition, I think we're going to have to really shift our thinking about how we think about all the celestial bodies of space to include the moon. And that's why I think it's really important to start talking about this subject today. So with that, let's get into the episode. Hello. Thank you again, Caitlin, for joining me on the podcast. I really appreciate you donating your time.
I'm happy to be here.
So I, for listeners, met Caitlin back in Professors Carrie Bingen and Steve Cattay's class last spring in their Space and National Security course. And learned a lot. That was my first exposure to space. So we're definitely going to be in for a great talk today. And also, shameless plug for the class. It was awesome, and the professors are great. So the important stuff right up front. Have you seen Dune yet? Will you see Dune? Is that kind of like you have to go see these space science fiction movies to work in your field?
I haven't seen it yet. I loved the first one. I've read the book. So looking forward to it.
I think it's
hit and miss. I mean, on the one hand, people who work in the space community tend to be the biggest space nerds you'll ever find, really love the subject matter in all of its forms. On the other hand, when you work in space and you spend 8 to 10 hours every workday focusing on that, sometimes you want to go home and not think about your job. So personally, it has to be something really good for me to go see it or watch it on space stuff. So I don't see all of the space shows. I have to get talked into it by friends who have like vetted them for me. So right now I'm actually watching For All Mankind, which is a really good one about like an alternative universe where the Soviet Union gets to the moon first or gets into space first, and how if we had pursued Apollo and shuttle to the moon and established a lunar base, what that might have looked like, which is super relevant to our conversation today.
Great launch pad. Let's start with some of the basics. So how would you define cislunar space, which maybe not a lot of people are super familiar with? And why is it that such a definition is not really widely accepted in the community?
Yeah, so let me put in a disclaimer. I currently work in the U.S. Space Force. Everything I'm going to say is first and foremost, unclassified. Second, my own personal opinion, not the opinion of the U.S. government, of the Department of Defense, even my boss, General Saltzman. It's all Caitlin's personal views, mostly informed from my years at CSIS, working on space security policy and cislunar space there. In 2022, I published a study called Fly Me to the Moon. And in there, I talk about the definition of cislunar space, because it's something I ran into with my research was this exact question you asked. You'd think there'd be an easy pre-described, here's exactly what cislunar space is. Everyone uses the same definition. And in fact, it's a little more challenging than that. Some people will use cislunar to describe basically anything outside of the Earth's atmosphere that kind of involves the moon, to the moon, a little bit around the moon. Some people will start that line at geo and say, okay, anything beyond geo or ex-geo to the moon, around the moon, is cislunar space. I tend to prescribe to that second definition. And it all really has to do with the three-body problem, which is a physics term that basically states that if you're a satellite in that space, you're not only contending with the gravitational pull from the Earth, but also from the Sun, and now from the Moon, because you're in the Moon's gravitational orbit or pull. And so that once a satellite kind of flips that switch, which is not a clear line, so it's actually very hard. It's obviously, it's like very 3D space. It's not just like, okay, this altitude out. So it's kind of like a bubble beyond geo, around the Moon. It includes these points called the Lagrange points, which we can get into, but is a commonly accepted definition as we start to talk about not just the physics of the environment, but also the policy that we might, or norms we might want to implement in it.
Great. Yeah. No, that sounds really similar to how we define space itself and how that is also kind of squishy for some, you know, going from government mm-hmm. to private sector and all that stuff. And yeah. there's kinds of a reason for that, but also like a fun area where, you know, science intersects with policy so much. And that's, I mean, I will never fully understand anything that someone who works in space on that level, you know, says, but it's so interesting how those intersect.
Well, I think that's what's so important about space policy is I don't have an engineering background. I don't have a physics background. I am an international affairs, national security expert by education and training. But you have to have that literacy. You have to be able to understand and have that conversation with the astrophysics community, with the aerospace engineers. And as long as you can do that and you can create that bridge between the two, you know, the kind of the policy side and the science and technology side, I think that's where the best work comes out of, that's where the best policy will come out of, is this kind of technically informed policy. So we're not suggesting things that are physically impossible or just don't make sense for the domain, and vice versa, so that the engineers and scientists working these programs understand the political impacts of what they're working on.
Yeah, super important. I run into that in my work all the time, and that's a skill that you need to build to be able to kind of translate to both those different parties. So I did read your CSIS report where you kind of aggregated a lot of current, future, military, commercial, civil mm-hmm. activities going on in this space now and, you know, coming up in the future. So if it's not too much to ask, I know you wrote this whole paper about it, but yeah. could you kind of give that general overview now of the landscape today and, you know, in cislunar and lunar space, and what are these parties trying to accomplish?
Yeah, so the amazing thing about that report is it was published in February 2022, and it is already way outdated. I mean, someone should rewrite this report for me to aggregate that data. My drive was to see, okay, the policy and space community started to talk openly about the going back to the Moon and all of these activities in cislunar space, and no one had done the nitty-gritty work of, okay, let me dig around and find what payloads are going into the cislunar environment or to the Moon itself, and what does that look like, not just from a U.S. perspective, but globally. And I think I found over 100, maybe upwards of 150 different missions headed to the Moon in the next 10 to 15 years, which is an incredible amount of not just of missions headed, but of investment from the world into the cislunar space and on the Moon. And a lot of the ones that I captured have already been launched and either were most unsuccessful, but some were successful. We saw the recent lunar landing by a U.S. commercial company just a couple weeks ago. So the overall point of that report was that it's not solely a U.S. interest. It's not solely a Chinese or Russian interest. We have interest across the world from all sorts of different nations and companies. And so it's not just governments or civil capabilities that are headed to the Moon or the cislunar environment. It's also investments in military technology and investments in commercial capability, because there are a lot of estimates of the potential economy that can come out of the cislunar environment and the Moon itself. And so trying to capture all of that in the report just to see and put numbers and data to the energy that's going there.
Yeah, it definitely seems a burgeoning environment, as space in general sort of is, and everything changes so quickly. So we've seen some past messaging from the White House, the Biden administration specifically, talking about cislunar space. So there was a 2022 National Cislunar Science and Technology Strategy that came out, which was the first of its kind. And that emphasized cislunar opportunities for bolstering, you know, international cooperation and scientific exploration. So kind of exactly what you were talking about, bringing all these interested groups together to kind of work towards a common goal. So does that sort of encapsulate all of U.S. interests in cislunar and lunar space, or is there also some a significant military mission on top of that?
Yeah, so I'd say I'm a big fan of that policy document. I think the team that worked on it did an incredible job, not just because I know them and they're friends of mine, but also because I know the amount of work that went into producing that and how many conversations and data points they gathered, not just from NASA, but from the rest of the U.S. government. It is focused on science and technology. It's not focused on military investment. So we see the focus much more on the civil side and the potential for different technologies that will enable future lunar sustained operations. So the one that jumps to mind is position, navigation, and timing, basically a lunar version of GPS in whatever that form it might take. It probably won't look like GPS at all, but we have to be able to navigate and on the moon, and astronauts will need to be able to determine their position while they're out on the lunar surface. So even like that kind of technology, which we take for granted here on Earth, how it will support the lunar environment and how it's the U.S. government's role to develop that kind of enabling technology so that commercial companies can get there and have, you know, safe and sustainable missions on the moon. While it captures a lot of the U.S. government interests in cislunar space, it is notably leaves out the military side, which you said. In my report from 2022, there were a couple of lunar U.S. military investments, and you can see them in places like DARPA, AFRL, the Air Force Research Laboratory, and some of these other kind of national labs or forward-thinking, smaller organizations. It's certainly not the Space Force's main mission and something that the Space Force is investing heavily in. And instead, you see it being picked up by the national labs and DARPA and these places that are ecosystems of innovation and technology. And often they create technologies or invest in technologies that are not just military focused, but have that kind of dual use focus that could support both civil and commercial missions, but also the U.S. military. And so if you dig around, you'll find some of those for sure.
Absolutely, yeah. So considering kind of the interesting and sort of unique historical experiences of different countries in space, specifically, you know, between the U.S. and Russia, and how we've had this long history of collaborating in at least this domain, if nothing else, you know, terrestrially, specifically, obviously, the infamous International Space Station. So how collaborative are states really with each other on lunar and cislunar projects, or are a lot of those relationships kind of more characterized as competitive and contentious?
So what I think you're seeing in the cislunar and lunar environment right now, from a policy side, is a demarcation of two camps. On the one hand, we have the Apollo or the Artemis program, which is led by the United States, but has over 30, I think upwards of 40 co-signatories from other nations around the world. And those are bilateral agreements between the United States and another country. So it's not one big multinational, multilateral agreement like the ISS is. It's more of a one-for-one. And it's a way for the United States to leverage allies and partners' expertise and experience to support the lunar mission. Now, the burden and the biggest investment is certainly coming from NASA and the United States government. And so you'll see most of the astronauts, the first astronauts, will all be American, for example. And a lot of the main structures and pieces might be American as well. But we've started to see some of the usual suspects of American alliances play out. So, for example, the Europeans are primarily on board, both in bilateral capacities, but also through the European Space Agency, which is a multinational agency that is akin to NASA. And so they're providing a lot of support to the Artemis program. I think what's also really interesting is the partnerships between smaller nations or less developed space nations and their ability to leverage partnership with the United States through the Artemis program to invest in their own space science and technology capability in their home nation. So some examples that I find particularly interesting, one is the United Arab Emirates, the UAE, incredible space nation, you know, small country size-wise and population-wise, but incredible resources and has really focused on STEM education and talent for the last 20 years. And so you're starting to see that effect of a nation investing in STEM with their space program. And it's for a relatively new entrant to the space world, they are moving mountains. They are doing really incredible things. And so they are a partner with the United States on Artemis. They are also a partner with that other camp I mentioned, which is the International Lunar Research Station, I believe it's called, the ILRS, which is China and Russia's moon base, basically. So the United Arab Emirates kind of has partnerships with both. And for me, that's incredibly interesting, and we'll come back to that. But the ILRS is an agreement between China and Russia, and then has other signatories similar to Artemis, has other countries that have signed on to support that effort. Some of them are those cross, they cross both, but not many. And there's also a lot less information about the Chinese and Russian station, timelines, progress, as probably expected. They don't have to document everything publicly like the United States does. And so, you know, we're waiting to see a bit about how that shapes up. But for me, what's really interesting are these nations that have relationships with both. Because as we see this bifurcation of the international system in cislunar space, I think it's easy for people to jump to the space race analogy. It's easy for people to automatically assume they're going to be extremely competitive and contentious. But I don't think it has to be that way. And I think some of these nations that can work with both sides and understand the priorities and goals of both could be great bridges across, at least for the peaceful use of outer space, the safety of astronauts and humans on the lunar surface, making sure that we have built agreements and safety procedures between, you know, both bases. Because at the end of the day, those astronauts and cosmonauts and taikonauts, they're going to be alone out there, and it's going to be really hard for them to get help. And so if we can start building these bridges before we actually send people to the moon, maybe leveraging these middle ground nations, I think that would be extremely advantageous for both sides.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, that UAE case is super fascinating. I remember reading in the news, I think it was their first launch ever, and their head of their agency, their space agency, was like a 30-something-year-old woman, which is crazy, amazing work that they're doing. So moving a little bit to like the logistical struggles of operating in space, we know that congestion is such a huge issue in the Earth orbital lanes. And are we seeing kind of some similar situational awareness issues in cislunar space? And have there been any steps to kind of form a framework that everyone buys into to govern behavior there?
So not yet. I think it would be a great effort for UN COPUS, the Committee on the Peaceful Uses of Outer Space, to take on. Is this, how do you pursue sustainability in cislunar space and around the moon? And I think it's even more challenging than it is here in Earth orbit. In Earth, near Earth orbit, we have the benefit of our atmosphere, which acts a little bit like a garbage disposal. If you have small satellites in low Earth orbit, they can burn up on their way back in and kind of cleans itself a little bit, which is why we focus a lot on deorbit rules in low Earth orbit. When you get out to geostationary orbit, we have the graveyard, which is above geo, and it is exactly what it sounds like. It's where all the dead satellites are, and they keep geo relatively clean and clear of non-functioning satellites because we know how precious that orbit is. In cislunar space, we don't have an atmosphere around the moon. So when you see and hear of spacecraft hard landing on the moon, that's a nice word for crashing. And so we are already littering the moon that way. You don't have these stable kind of graveyard orbit either. If you're super interested in cislunar space, I mean, I really encourage you to like go around and Google and read some papers, but I'll give you my layman's explanation of cislunar orbits are nearly infinite and unpredictable. With small changes of delta V of energy, spacecraft can basically choose their own adventure in cislunar space. And I had a friend describe it to me as spaghetti, and that the orbits aren't ellipses like they are near Earth, that often they're all these crazy weird shapes, they're unpredictable, because just a little bit of change can actually really throw a satellite in a different direction. So they're hard to predict. It makes operating in the cislunar environment extremely challenging. It also makes the potential for space domain awareness in the cislunar environment also challenging. But it makes trash extremely challenging, because there could be a case where you send trash out on an orbit and it comes back, right? Which would not be great in 100 years for some trash from the, you know, the 2024 whatever lunar mission to show back up. Like, that would suck. So we don't want to damn our future selves. So it's really kind of an unsolved problem. I know there were some astrodynamicists at Princeton working on this, but it needs, this is where that policy and technical skill sets really need to align. You need the technical experts to help propose feasible solutions, and you need the policy to be able to regulate internal, you know, national explorations or missions to cislunar space, and you need that international relations discussion to have common buy-in, education, and awareness across the globe. My hope is that it's a relatively blank sheet of paper out there. We know the challenges we've faced and will continue to face with debris in near-Earth orbits. We can do better in cislunar space, and we have the obligation to.
Yeah, no, that's super helpful. So how do the Lagrange points come into this? And I've heard them described as critical choke points, so they seem really important.
Yeah, so Lagrange points are stable places in space. And I think, first, there are Lagrange points between any two bodies. So we have, what we're talking about are the Earth-Moon Lagrange points. There are also Earth-Sun Lagrange points. For example, the James Webb Telescope is in an Earth-Sun Lagrange point way, way out there. But this is like a relatively stable point in space, so that you always know where the James Webb Telescope is going to be. It doesn't have to expend a ton of fuel for station keeping. You can plan to communicate with it. So they're very valuable because of the stability they offer. They're not these spaghetti, crazy orbits. Mm-hmm. They are a little bit parked. You orbit around basically the Lagrange point. A lot of policy professionals will talk about the Lagrange point as chokeholds or the ultimate high ground. And I'd like to push back on it a bit, because they are not small enough that if someone else gets there first, there's no way that somebody else can't operate in there. They're still fairly large. I think there's a slight advantage of you get to design your mission as exactly as you want in a Lagrange point if you're there first, because there's nothing else to contend with. Whereas if you show up second to me, you have to design yours around where my satellite already is. But my satellite being there does not exclude your satellite being there. They're large, they're known, and they're relatively stable, so you can design safe orbits in Lagrange points. So there's one in between the Earth and the Moon. That's where the Lunar Gateway that NASA is building is going to go. And it's just kind of this like transportation hub in between the future moon base and Earth, so that you don't have to constantly send everything all the way to the moon every single time. Mm-hmm. And then there are two kind of out on the sides. I'm doing gestures, which I understand we can't see in the podcast, but there's two kind of out to the sides on the left and right of the moon. And then there's one on the other side, the far side of the moon. And we know there are satellites over there right now. And the Chinese have several satellites in that Lagrange point at the moment, because they have a rover on the far side of the moon. And that's how you have to communicate, because the rover sends the communication or the data to those satellites. Mm-hmm. Those satellites are far enough away that they can send that data back to Earth or back to communication satellites in near-Earth orbit. So those are very important as well. And then there's one on the opposite side of the Earth, like a balance between where the moon is and where this Lagrange point is. So these are gravitational stable points, and I hope that was a decent okay explanation, but if you're super interested, definitely Google or Wikipedia and don't just listen to me.
No, I think that makes tons of sense. And there's plenty of diagrams out there. I also had to scratch my head looking at the different dots, on a map. Mm-hmm. And that's super helpful to anyone super curious. Shifting gears once again to kind of the legal questions around cislunar space. how do documents like the 1967 Outer Space Treaty impact, I mean, some commercial interests in on the moon, et cetera, are around mm-hmm. resource extraction and, you know, the sort of missions we've talked about so far about scientific exploration. But how does a document like that impact those goals? And then, you know, considering the treaty, for those who don't know, maybe some background, this treaty, you know, asserts that no state can claim territory on the moon or other celestial bodies. And it also prohibits anybody from conducting military operations or putting weapons on the moon and stuff. How are those missions kind of impacted by that treaty? And are there any similar international, you know, agreements, binding or not, that could help manage any potential points of conflict or escalation?
I'll start with the second part of your question mm-hmm. because the Moon Agreement is a relatively unsuccessful as far as international agreements go, agreement the U.S. is not a party to it, and tried to lay down some international regulations for the moon. Many states have ratified it but not signed it. Many states have signed it. I think it's in the 20s or 30s, so not very many, I guess. And many, many states have not done anything with it, including the United States. The policy community, there's not a lot of talk about reviving it. People kind of know that's a little bit dead in the water. So instead, we often talk about the Outer Space Treaty, which had extreme foresight in including these parameters around the moon. And they are something that all nations have had to contend with. And I'll use the Artemis program as an example because I know it best. So the Artemis program and the Artemis Accords declared that resource extraction on the moon was legal. Per the Outer Space Treaty, per U.S. regulation and law, to incentivize commercial companies to go there and also for the U.S. government. And what people think is on the moon, which is not well documented because we haven't been to the moon in decades, and besides the commercial lander that just landed in February, but the science and technology of what minerals and rare earth materials are actually there is pretty low. So a lot of it is best guess and estimates based on old data from the Apollo era. Then also data that you could only collect data through the satellite, like a satellite. So not a lot of like core samples and things like that. They think there's water there, which is super important. Water in the form of ice, super important for possibly creating rocket fuel, because you can separate the hydrogen and the oxygen. They think that in the regolith that there is enough, I believe, also oxygen that you could separate. And then there are also estimates of rare earth materials, again, in the regolith and in the surface of the moon that we have a hard time finding here on Earth, rare earth. I challenge it just because mining operations on the moon seem extremely challenging and expensive. They're most likely going to be robotic. But how much money are you putting in to get that small amount of rare earth back? So I think it might be a while until that economics proposition really shakes out. But the U.S. did come out and say, we believe that we are following the law, international laws, and then our own. And so as a signatory to the Artemis Accords, different nations who want to work with the United States on the Artemis program sign the Artemis Accords, in which they also agree. So we kind of see the ball rolling. And that is why, even though the Artemis Accords came out years ago, you are still slowly seeing countries sign up to it. It's not because they're changing their mind. It's often because you're having these big political and legal debates in their own home nation of, do they feel that the Outer Space Treaty can be interpreted in this way, where you can, if you go, you can claim the resources and bring them home for your own use. Russia and China like to say that that's against the treaty, but then again, they don't offer any other perspective except for saying that the U.S. is doing something illegal. So it's hard to have that conversation with those countries. And it's hard to know, again, what they're planning with their lunar missions and if they will, you know, speak out of one side of their mouth and do something else. So, but those are really the only rules. You set them. No military bases, no weapons, no claiming of territory. And that is ensured through a couple ways, one of which is the assurance of reciprocal visits between astronauts and another nation's astronauts or another nation's lunar base on the moon, which again, to me, is like, we need to get out in front of actually establishing lunar bases, because in the Outer Space Treaty it says that you have to be able to open your doors basically and allow other nations to come and visit your lunar base if they also have a lunar base. And that, you know, transparency and safety to kind of reassure sides who might be in contention that neither side is doing hostile and nefarious things. And I think that will be a really hard thing to implement that we should work on before we actually have astronauts living permanently on the lunar surface.
Yeah, that makes plenty of sense. So kind of shifting gears a little to China. Mm-hmm. And I know you mentioned, information is pretty sparse and we're kind of at the mercy of what they release to the world. But their presence in space is obviously growing and their space-based capabilities are getting better and better. We've seen. So how have they operated in cislunar space and on the moon, and what seem to be their strategic goals?
Sure. So China has, as I said, a rover on the far side of the moon. It's operational well past its intended life, which we often see from NASA rovers on Mars. So, you know, they lowball it and say, we can assure this amount of life, and these are the missions we're going to plan for that that time period, and then everything else is just extra goodness. And so we saw that, for example, with the NASA helicopter on Mars. It was only supposed to fly a handful of times. It flew for like 4 years. It just died. It was very sad, but incredible technology. And so the Chinese have similarly been able to extend the life of their rover on the far side. We've got those communication satellites that are in the Lagrange point on the far side of the moon so that the rover can communicate as well and send the data back as well. I know the Chinese have also taken lunar samples and brought it back robotically. Those were the first lunar samples returned since Apollo. That was a couple of years ago. So they're doing a lot of work that NASA did in the 60s, but also they're very timely. They set goals for themselves. China as a nation often sets goals for itself and hits every single one. So they're very predictable and reliable in that way of when they do announce a goal. I think we should take them seriously that not only will they hit it, they will hit it on time or early, which cannot always be said for the United States. And of course, we have our own challenges with consistent funding and things like that, which often delay our goals. So we've seen China move out. We know that they are investing in not only their low Earth orbit space station, but also the future lunar base. And Russia has signed up for a partner. So they talk about it like they're co-equal partners, but frankly, Russia's space capabilities are not robust and they're not evolving with the times. They're often capabilities that they've had since, you know, the 90s and the 80s with the Soviet Union, and they're just kind of recapitalizing on that. There's been a lot of brain drain in the country, and of course now a lot of resourcing that is being diverted to their invasion and war on Ukraine. Politically, obviously, I think it makes a lot of sense for Russia and China to align, to team up. But if you look at their political and historical cooperation, they're not, you know, the best of bedfellows. They actually have a lot of contention between the two nations, not just on sovereign territory between both, but also in trust issues and cooperation amongst the two. As we see those plans emerge and what China's contributing versus what Russia plans to contribute, I'm super interested in seeing how that relationship evolves and what really shakes out. And then again, all of these other space nations or emerging space nations that are joining the ILRS mission set instead of the Artemis one.
So with that, are there any Chinese programs that you foresee, especially, you know, maybe this lunar station that they're planning and working towards? I've heard their behavior sort of characterized, or their like outlook on lunar missions, as territorial, and they want to maybe go against this sort of idea of an international commons and this idea that we've talked about with the Outer Space Treaty. Does the U.S. need to do anything to deter that behavior, or are they doing anything currently to do that?
Certainly. So I think the concern that you're mentioning is often related to how China has expanded its reach in its own regional area. And the South China Sea obviously comes to mind, but so does its influence over Taiwan. And being able to create barriers, barrier islands to mainland China and have that kind of protection extended beyond the internationally agreed upon, like nautical waters even. And so I think there's a concern that China will continue to act in that way in space. The moon is huge. And even if you look up NASA's, like, they have 12 possible places they want to put the Artemis base. I'm sure there's a favorite or two, but at the same time, you know, I personally don't believe in first mover advantage for the Chinese to get to the moon first, just because I think that there are many places that are advantageous. And even if they get to the moon first, I don't think we're far behind. The concern of them gaining territory or claiming territory on the moon, I mean, it clearly goes against the Outer Space Treaty. It's very explicit. They have not gone up against the Outer Space Treaty yet in near Earth space, so it's not like they have a habit of doing that. However, you can see the international policy community trying to preemptively establish norms and rules and behave like responsible behaviors for not just near Earth space, but also cislunar space in the moon. And I think that's something that you will hear in my own comments that I really advocate for. It's coming up with these arrangements before we actually get there, because then I think it just gets increasingly complex. And so finding a way to work across the international system, which often takes a very long time, is incredibly important and something that we need to pursue to set those norms of behavior and establish those rules. And I think that's in itself a form of deterrence. We certainly have to work together and make it beneficial for everyone. And the safety, I think, of astronauts is a great place to start in Taikonauts, of ensuring those processes or communication lines or whatever it may be, because they will be, you know, basically kind of stranded there if something goes wrong. And so starting from a place of concern on human safety, and we've heard the Chinese talk a lot about human safety with their Taikonauts on their space station in near Earth orbit and low Earth orbit. I think picking up on that thread and starting the conversation there might be helpful to then building more norms of behaviors or agreements to work towards a safe and sustainable future.
Yeah, the dream.
The dream.
Well, thank you, Caitlin, again for joining me today. That was all my questions. If you have anything that you'd like to share that you think we need to really foot stomp on your end, you're the expert, please feel free.
To me, cislunar space is just incredibly interesting. Again, we know all these problems we have in near Earth orbit, whether that is the trash or having crowded orbits and access issues or quality equity issues. And so I think knowing all those will only help us make cislunar space better. And again, we have the obligation to do better in cislunar space and for the future environment. But it's a very exciting time to be in the space community, because wrapping it back up to the start of our session, all of these, not just US government, but international and commercial ventures, so many people are getting to be a part of this new kind of space future in the States, not just engineers, but policy people like us, as well as, I mean, think about the doctors we'll need for the lunar surface and finance and accounting and all that. I always tell people you could do anything. You can be a lawyer, you can be a doctor, you can have any field and tie it to space. And I think that will become increasingly true as we continue to go back to the moon.
Amazing. Well, thank you again.
You're
this
welcome.
Is super informative. I really enjoyed it. Thanks.
As a reminder, the views expressed on this podcast are the views of the participants alone and do not represent the views or opinions of Georgetown University, the Precision Guided Podcast, the U.S. government, or any other agency. Thank you for listening to the Precision Guided Podcast. Follow the Georgetown Security Studies Review on social media to stay up to date on the latest Precision Guided Podcast episodes and GSSR content. You can find us on Twitter, Facebook, and LinkedIn, or you can visit our website at georgetownsecuritystudiesreview.org. Thank you to all of our listeners out there. This is the Precision Guided Podcast, the official podcast of the Georgetown Security Studies Review.